Okay. So wonderful to see some friendly faces, some new faces. We're really glad you took time out on this beautiful day to come join us for this very special event with author Ari Berman to discuss his new book, Minority Rule. This is an event that is sponsored, presented by David Orr of Good Government Illinois, and my name is Lisa Kaplan. I'm the Executive Director of Reform for Illinois. It's my honor to introduce David before we get started. David is a leading reformer who served as Cook County Clerk from 1990 to 2018. Before that, he was an independent alderman and vice mayor under Mayor Harold Washington, and completed the mayor of Chicago. He founded the organization Good Government Illinois to promote transparent and equitable government following his retirement. Most importantly, he has served as a distinguished board member of my organization, Reform for Illinois. And today is a very special day because we are officially welcoming Good Government Illinois and David Orr to the Reform for Illinois family. We couldn't be more excited about this development. As of today, our organizations have joined forces for good government and for a stronger Illinois democracy. David will be serving as a senior policy advisor for RFI, and this is our first joint event in our new form. So I'd like to hand it over to David so he can get us started. The Honorable David Orr.
Honorable politicians doesn't always. Thank you, Lisa, my new boss. It's kind of embarrassing somewhere to be mentioned that you were mayor of Chicago because most people don't believe you. It wasn't just the shortest term in history, but there was a major record there that many of you probably don't know, and that is I'm the only mayor that I think any of you will ever meet that never raised taxes in my entire
life.
In 2 months? Well, we'll see. So welcome everybody, and welcome Ari Berman. We're very grateful that you're here. He's doing a big event later with Martha Jones, but he called. And some of you might remember we did something with him, you know, years ago, when he had his earlier book, Give Us the Ballot. And we had a nice crowd at the time, so congratulations on bringing a good crowd. So, Jake, Lisa mentioned some of the co-sponsors. Just quickly, they're up here. But let me mention that. We appreciate the Good Government Illinois, which will be kind of fading away, and joining with the Reform for Illinois. League One for Voters, thanks to Jane Booby here, because she's been a big help in talking to that as well. And Jane is head of the League of Women Voters here in Chicago. The Center for Budget and Tax Accountability, and they're the ones that got us this thing at Roosevelt University. We also appreciate Chang Illinois and Chang Illinois. That's all we do. Thank you. And Common Cause.
Thank you.
And the Real Side of Democracy for America. So quickly, you see, Jane is going to be taking this information, okay? So if you individually or in your groups, if it turns out with your video and oral, otherwise, well, assuming it turns out okay, that's available if you want to send your groups to the people that live in Chicago, we can get there. So just follow up with us on that. There's going to be a book signing afterwards. We have one problem with the register. What's the point of me, because I'm not very good at tech. So we got 20 books. I'm going to buy all the books. That's the only way they can do it, except maybe get them from the store. So if you want to buy books and you think about $33 and get it to be fine, if not, that's just life. But I will be around to sign the books. Okay? So I think we're ready to go. Let me just reintroduce Elisa first, because Elisa and I will be asking our questions. And we'll mention some of the questions that some of us sent earlier. We tied a lot of those in, particularly because a lot of the questions were, what do we do? So, Elisa, as I mentioned before, was an executive director of Reform for Illinois. That's an organization, a nonpartisan organization here in Illinois that focuses on campaign finance reform, elections, all sorts of election reforms. She's often in the media, interviewed frequently, and I'm really looking forward to working with her. Yes, I'm on the board, working more closely with them. And as for Ari, let me just do a quick interview so we save our time for the conversation. Ari is a senior reporter for Martin Jones and a fellow at Type Media Center. He has written extensively about American politics, voting rights, and the intersection of modern politics. Ari was the first national reporter to cover voter suppression way back in 2012. He's the author, as I mentioned before, of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which the book was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. He's got a lot of kudos for his work. And he also wrote Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And he has local roots. He's a graduate of the Medill School of Journalism, and his professor, Jeff Toff, is here today to make sure he's okay, so let's get the founder on the
go. Sounds good, yeah. Okay, all right, so we'll start off pretty general here. Americans, I'm sure many people in this room often wonder why Congress doesn't seem to get things done. Especially things that broad majorities of Americans seem to support. We've got broad majorities of Americans supporting voting rights reform, campaign finance reform, gun safety, immigration reform, reproductive rights, many other important things. Yet supporters of these issues have a very hard time getting laws passed in Congress. Tell us how your book helps to explain that.
Well, thanks so much. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for everyone coming on their lunch hour, even though there's no lunch. And thanks so much to all the groups that have organized this. It's an all-star lineup. And thanks so much to David for doing this. He's such a good guy, and that was even before he bought all the books. It's really great to be back in Chicago. I went to Northwestern. I grew up in Iowa. Chicago was the big city, my home away from home, even before I went to school here. Jack was my law and ethics and journalism professor, so if I say anything morally questionable, he'll be the first to mention it. But it's really nice to be here, and thanks to everyone for coming. And the last thing I'll say in the intro is that I just saw the place sucks. About suffragette movement, and I saw that today is actually the anniversary of Congress ratifying the 19th Amendment, and my friend, Nate James, played Ida B. Wells in the play, so it's really cool that we're doing this in the Ida B. Wells room on Ida B. Wells Drive. So shout out to Ida B., a trailblazing journalist and visionary. So my last book really flows into this book, because I was covering voting rights for almost a decade when I had the idea for this book. And the way it came about was I was asking the question, why do people want to make it hard for some people to vote? Is it just about winning elections, or is there a larger project here? And I realized there was a larger project, and that larger project was minority rule. So an elite and privileged conservative white minority could hold a majority of power despite only having a minority of support. And basically, the idea was that they didn't have to moderate. They could just block popular policies from becoming law, put unpopular policies into law, and then take advantage of a fundamentally undemocratic system, which I know we'll get into, and then layer on top of that all of these newer anti-democratic tactics that we're seeing today.
Can you go a little further, explain how we got there? Take us back to the founding era, please. Still close?
Yeah.
Also,
that's it.
Back to the founding era, what were some of the key discussions and decisions made by the constitutional framers that enabled minorities to rule, at least get that whole concept started?
Yeah, and so the question that I had once I realized that the larger project was minority rule is when did it begin? That was sort of my starting point, and I realized it began at the beginning, right? And there was this fundamental tension, because the Declaration of Independence says democracy is based on the consent of the governed. And there's this very utopian language in there about majority rule. But the early democratic experiment, when states were quite democratic for the time and began passing more popular policies, scared a lot of the founding fathers. And the founding fathers said, yeah, we want to create a democracy, but we're not so sure if we want to create a democracy that threatens our interests, that threatens the interests of a white male property owning, in many cases, slaveholding elite, which was a distinct minority at the time. So when I'm talking about minority rule, I'm not talking about minorities as we tend to think of that. I'm not talking about women or African Americans or Native Americans or other marginalized communities. The minority rule that founders were concerned with was this elite white male property minority, which was very much a distinct minority at the time, right? So they began thinking, what can we do to curb what they call the excesses of democracy? And so they called the Constitutional Convention in 1787 largely to create a government that will shut people out of democracy as opposed to encouraging them. So there's a few ways they do this. First, there's the structure of the government of itself. Only the House of Representatives is going to be elected by the people. So senators are not elected by the people. Senators are elected, well, they're nominated by state legislatures and chosen by the lower house. So Senate is not elected by the people. The president was elected by the people because they fear the ability of the people to elect the president. So that's also off the table in terms of democratic participation. The Supreme Court will be chosen by senators who are not elected by the people and appointed by senators. So chosen by senators who are not elected by the people, chosen by presidents who are not elected by the people, and confirmed by senators who are not elected by the people. So that's the three branches of government right there. Then it was further skewed because of all of these compromises that are more like concessions, really. So even though the House is elected by the people, the slave states say, well, if the people elect the House, there's no protections for us, the free states are going to have more representatives than the slave states. So the slave states come up with a three-fifths compromise, which essentially says that slaves, even though they can't vote and they really have no rights, are going to be treated as three-fifths of a person for purpose of representation, meaning the slave states get a third more members in the House than they would have otherwise. The small states do the same thing with the Senate. They say, we want the same number of senators as the larger states. And some of the most prominent founders say, that's crazy. The Senate should be based on proportional representation. But the small states say, you don't give us the same number of power, we might leave the Union and go join France, which is pretty much the worst thing you could say in some sense. So then the small states, they get the disproportionate share of the Senate. Then when it comes to the Electoral College, that's based on representation in the House and the Senate, right? So therefore, when it comes to the Electoral College, the slave states and the small states start to have more power in terms of choosing the president. So the net effect of this, if you look at the beginning of the country, 10 of the first 12 U.S. presidents are slaveholders. 18 of the first 31 Supreme Court justices are slaveholders. And then most speakers of the House are slaveholders. What this does is this basically ingrains the idea of minority in the government. So even when things start to democratize, right, voting rights are expended for white men, and then they're extended for black men, and then they're extended for white women, and then eventually for a lot much larger group of people when the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. This idea that a privileged elite white minority needs to be protected, that begins in 1787, that sort of is a dominant through line throughout the story.
So we're going to talk a lot in this discussion about how minoritarian institutions are bad. But I just did want to ask, and you touch on this a little bit in your book, are there any benefits to certain types of minoritarian institutions?
Yeah.
We're not the only country that has a Senate that allots the same weight to each unit of government.
Sure. I think absolutely there's benefits to protecting minority populations in a democracy. That's what distinguishes democracy from autocracies and other forms of government, is the protection of minority rights. And one of the big struggles throughout American history is that those previously disenfranchised communities become part of democracy because they were in many ways shut out from the founding, since the founding. The problem is this is kind of the inverse of that. This is basically an elite white minority that's holding power by disenfranchised the previously disenfranchised minority group. So it's kind of taken the inverse problem. And the problem with our institutions is they're all slanted in one direction in terms of who they benefit. There's this overrepresentation of white, conservative, rural America in terms of the Electoral College, in terms of the Senate, in terms of how Supreme Court justices are chosen, in terms of how the Supreme Court acts. And it's not like Brown versus Board of Education. those kind of examples where minority rights are protected in a way that is good for the country writ large, but might be at odds with the majority opinion, those are pretty rare. More often, it's a powerful minority doing things that are at odds with the majority. And I think there's a difference between protecting minority rights and a situation where you have a powerful minority that's holding the majority in power. And that starts to get at odds with basic ideas of democracy being based on the consent of the government.
Let me follow up with the issue, and you've been discussed it in a number of different ways, of race, particularly of race, the history, and where it brings us today. And the specific question of covering a lot of ground as we are, how did the election of Barack Obama lead to a radicalization against democracy from some of these groups?
Yeah. Well, I was here. I was in Grant Park. I'm sure some of you were as well.
I was monitoring the election.
Yeah.
I couldn't know
it. I jumped the fence from the press box because I knew it was a historic moment that was right next to Jesse Jackson when it happened. And he was crying. And it was an incredible moment for the country. And I think a lot of people thought this was going to be the new norm in American politics, not just the election of the black president, but the amazing multiracial coalition that elected Barack Obama. That if you look at the electorate, there were 5 million new voters that turned out in 2008. 2 million were black, 2 million were Latino, 600,000 were Asian American. So nearly the entire growth of the electorate was voters of color. And Obama's coalition was called by the journalist Ron Brown, so the coalition of the ascendant. The idea was that moderate, progressive whites, younger people, people of color, this was the future of America. Now, those on the losing side of that didn't feel that way. They felt the opposite. To them, Obama's election was exactly what they feared, which was essentially the death of, or the coming death of, white Christian America. And I write in my book begins with Pat Buchanan in the 1990s. And the reason why it began with Pat Buchanan in the 1990s is he starts warning before any other major politician that the country is going to enter a majority-minority future. The Census Bureau predicts in the 90s that this is going to happen in 2050. He starts saying, if white people become the minority, that is going to be an existential crisis for one political party that is relying on white voters. And I don't think it takes genius to figure out which party that is. And also for the dominant white power structure that's ruled the country for 200 years. And I think it's the fear of a majority-minority future mixed with the concrete results of what that's bringing. The election for first black president starts to lead to this radicalization against democracy. And I think where you see it most notably is in the Tea Party movement, which they say is about economics, but it's really about race. And then what happens when swing states start to shift after the 2010 election, and different people are in charge in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and they start pushing all these anti-democratic policies. This is how I start covering this issue. I'm noticing, how is it that the policies on voting are changing in Florida, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, all at the same time, just 2 years after we elected the first black president? That seems like kind of a coincidence. Maybe there's something behind this. And that radicalization against democracy, in my view, lays the groundwork for Donald Trump. Because if there hadn't already been a radicalization against democracy, an authoritarian leading figure like Trump wouldn't have been able to clinch the nomination of one of the two major parties.
Let me just do one quick follow-up on that, because if you haven't read the book yet, loading with some fantastic facts, and I might not have exact right, Pat Buchanan's, having a heart attack, because he looked at the numbers of a certain between 2000 and 2010, I'm not sure if I got the numbers exactly right, white population went up by 1%, black population went up by 15%, Latino population went up by 46%, and the Asian population went up even more. So again, so much was going on before this time, and the people shaped, as I call it, modern right wing, or the minority, whatever you want to call it, they were all totally fascinated and disturbed by the fear of losing their white majority.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because in a 14-month span in the 1960s, from 1964 to 1965, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passes, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passes, and the Immigration Act of 1965 passes. And this dramatically changes the demography of the country, the democratization of the country, and the rights of the country, which previously disenfranchised communities have a much greater stake in America. America starts changing, starts extending new rights to formerly disenfranchised communities, and starts letting new people into the country. And that lays the ground for the country to become a majority minority. What Buchanan does initially, like as a speechwriter for Richard Nixon, is he helps come up with the Southern Strategy. And when he sees cops at Grant Park beating the anti-war protesters, he sees it as an opportunity. He sees this as a backlash that he can rob. So he takes antipathy towards the civil rights movement and then the rights movements in general in the 60s. And then he mixes that with antipathy towards non-white immigration, which he views in the 90s as a coming culture. He starts talking about building a Buchanan fence along the U.S.-Mexico border, calls for a moratorium on all immigration so that America can become more Americanized, repealing things like birthright citizenship. So this is back in the 90s. And so you realize that a lot of what we're talking about today is a new version of an old fight. It's not, it's, yes, we can live in unprecedented times, but the times aren't as unprecedented as we think in terms of long-term strategy behind the movement we see today inside the Republic.
You've actually got a great little bit in there when Pat Buchanan was trying to become the reform candidate for president, and they interviewed Donald Trump, who I think had some ideas about that too, and Donald Trump was like, this guy, he doesn't like black people, he doesn't like gays, he doesn't like immigrants.
Yeah.
Who's going to go for this guy?
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, he says, I mean, in true Trump fashion, he says he doesn't like the blacks, he doesn't like the gays, that's the language he uses. And then he, but he's realizing, like, okay, Trump's trying to figure out what's going to be salient to this white backlash electorate. And he starts realizing, you know, opposition to demographic change, opposition to immigration, the whole slogan of Make America Great Again. What kind of America is he talking about? He's talking about the pre-Grant Park America. And that's the America he's talking about. He's not talking about the America where Michelle, Sasha, Malia, and Barack walk on stage. He's talking about the America that predated that. And I think that that's something that I think we don't focus on enough, how so much of the underpinning of this is race and how that's a problem that we've never solved. It's built into the undemocratic structure of institutions. Then there's these newer anti-democratic movements that are latent.
So we have a couple of questions, including one by Donald Winter, about the role of wealth concentration in all of this. And it would seem that wealth concentration plays two types of roles, right? It's got two pathways. Can you talk about the different ways that wealth is playing into this whole?
Well, first off, the rising level of inequality has strengthened the power of the elite white minority because they're more important than ever before. And then the deregulation of money in politics has given a much greater ability for this. Pretty much the most powerful minority group in the country, the 0.1%, I mean, you can't get any more elite minority than that, to influence the political system. And I talk about how it didn't just influence the system nationally, it influences the state, right? Because I write a lot about Wisconsin, you know, a state many of you guys are familiar with, and how that state kind of became a laboratory for oligarchy. And I basically say in the book, the United States has been a laboratory for democracy and oligarchy. It hasn't been one or the other. It's often been both at various times. And these clashing ideas of who should democracy represent, who should democracy be for. And a lot of these things played out with Wisconsin, because Wisconsin, in many ways, had this progressive history. It was a place that gave rise to collective bargaining rights for unions and things like the first programs for Social Security. But I think after 2010, it was pushed in a different direction to do things like make it harder to vote, repeal rights for labor unions, gerrymander so that one party would rule no matter how people voted. And a lot of money was funneled into the system to support that. And I think that has gotten dramatically worse today, to the point where, you know, we have conservative activists that are funding the takeover of the Supreme Court. And we can't even track where the money's coming from. We don't even know where the money's coming from. And one person can get a $1 billion donation from someone in Chicago, like that. And that money is spent to influence the political system, and we can't even track. So I think it's a big part. And that's why one of the things I try to do as a journalist is connect the dots. Because I think a lot of people think that these things are separate, that money is different than voting. or that a tax on labor are different than gerrymandering. And what I'm trying to say, it's a whole system that's being set up trying to concentrate minority rule. And I think, you know, it's sometimes overwhelming to think about it like that. But I also think it's clarifying in terms of trying to figure out the problem we have to solve.
You know, if you haven't read the book again, this is still with so many things that are totally relevant to the political struggles today. Let me just jump over for a second, because a lot of people, when they sit in questions, again, they emphasize, what do we do, what do we do? And I believe, basically, look at how do we promote democracy. And you do a lot about Michigan.
Yeah.
So how is Michigan a model for expanding democracy?
Another state that a lot of people aren't familiar with. I'm sure some people here spend the summer there and have spent a lot of time there. It's always tough for me as an Iowan to praise Michigan, but I'm gonna do it anyway. I was a ball boy at the University of Iowa when the Fab Five came, and that was still a highlight of my life, but throwing balls and wiping Chris Webber's sweat up. It's a fascinating example because, you know, Michigan was a state where politics seemed very rigged, where one party would get a minority of votes in the legislature, but a majority of seats. And it was really exhibit A for broken state government. The Flint water crisis being the most prominent example of how a broken political process, where essentially unaccountable undemocratic emergency managers came in, switched the water supply based essentially on corporate greed, and led to one of the worst public health disasters possible. And people started organizing against this. And one of the really interesting things was Michigan was one of about two dozen states that allow citizen organized ballot machines. And I tell the story of how one reformer, people who will be familiar with, Katie Fahey, put an initiative on the ballot to ban partisan gerrymandering. And amazingly, it got on the ballot and it passed. And if you look at Michigan, from the span of 2018 to 2022, they passed ballot initiatives to end partisan gerrymandering. They passed ballot initiatives to dramatically expand voting rights through things like automatic election day registration, things that Illinois has adopted, things like early voting, no absentee voting, combating election subversion, and on other issues, doing things like enshrining abortion rights, legalizing marijuana. I think it's such a good example because when we think of things as a D versus R context, it's always 50-50. But then you look at how these things do when they're on the ballot. They're passing the 65-70% of vote. They're passing in Trump counties. The majority of counties that voted for Donald Trump voted to ban partisan gerrymandering, voted to make it easier to vote. And for the first time in 2022, Michigan Democrats just flipped the legislature, but the popular vote totals equaled exactly the number of seats in the legislature. And when I asked the organizers of Michigan, what do you think about this? They said, we're happy not because Democrats took over. We're happy because it led to a fair Democratic outcome. So I think it's one blueprint. There's other blueprints for change. Wisconsin has changed a lot because different people have been elected. Things like state Supreme Courts have changed. And one of my messages of the book is, well, there's really three things, can I just say what my solutions are more broadly. Number one is elect pro-democracy candidates. It sounds obvious, but that doesn't mean elect Democrats. I think it's really, really important. You guys live in a state. There's been a lot of Democrats in Illinois that haven't been pro-democracy, right? When I was in college, the mayor was not pro-democracy, and most of the institutions were not controlled by pro-democracy. So there's a distinction. And there's been Republicans that have been really good on democracy issues. There's been Democrats that have been really bad on democracy issues. So I think making democracy a central thing, a central issue, and electing for democracy next is number one. Number two is building a longer-term movement for institutional reform. Back in the 1960s, Lewis Powell, who was the head of the Chamber of Commerce and future Supreme Court Justice, wrote a very influential memo that basically said the right was losing. They were losing to all the different rights movement, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. They were losing the war of ideas. And he basically said, we need a 30 to 40 year plan to take over foundations, courts, academia. So this was a strategy. It wasn't like one day people woke up and it was a 6-3 conservative supermajority, 6-4. This was part of the strategy. I think there needs to be more talk in small D and big D Democratic circles about what reform looks like, what it looks like to get rid of an electoral college or pass the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which I'm pretty sure Illinois has passed, how to reform the filibuster. Why wasn't voting rights the top priority of the administration? Why did they try to do infrastructure? So you're building a bunch of bridges in a broken system. Wouldn't it make sense to change the system? And then it's a lot easier to not just build bridges, but to do a million other things as well. So I think a lot of times this stuff seems as process issues, but if democracy is rigged, everything else is rigged as well. Not the way that Donald Trump says, but in the way that, like you said, you can't protect a woman's right to choose. You can't have clean air and water. You can't have reasonable gun control or criminal justice reform if you're operating on the basis of a broken system that's at odds with majority rule. And the third thing that I think is so important is to organize locally. Jay has the great shirt, local elections map. I can't tell you how many times people come up to me in New York and say, I'm so mad about what's happening in Wisconsin. I'm so mad about what's happening in Georgia. And I'm like, you know, New York hasn't had the greatest voting laws in a long time. And we don't have the greatest system of democracy in New York State right now. We have half a dozen competitive congressional elections that are to decide control of the House. You don't need to go to Wisconsin to decide control of the House. You just need to organize in the Hudson Valley or Staten Island or Wallowland. And I think it's the same thing with Illinois, right? A lot of things can be done in Illinois. If you can't live in Illinois, you can very easily get to Wisconsin and Michigan and these other places where I think you'll be treated a little bit more kindly than someone from New York or someone from California going in. And right now, all state battles are national. And I think the right understood that. They understand if we can pass a restrictive abortion law, if we can pass a restrictive voting law, that's something that other states will have. And I think things move in the other direction. I think Illinois has been a good example of this in recent years. You pass a good law on reproductive rights. You pass a good law on voting rights. You pass a good law on criminal justice reform. That's something that other states can emulate. It not only benefits a lot of people here, but it's something that other states can emulate at the time when all state battles are national battles. And state courts, state constitutions can change a lot quicker than the national courts, national constitutions. So I think the importance of state and local organizing is really critical right now.
Let me take it back to federal politics, although I really appreciate as an organization that focuses on state and local issues and gets a little frustrated sometimes with how much oxygen the federal government and federal politics sucks up.
Yeah.
So everybody, please take the lesson, pay attention to your state and local politics. I guess if you're here, you probably would. follow reforms in Illinois, because that's what we're about. But let's take it back to Congress. And how much of this problem is on the federal level, is the filibuster? You've got some astonishing statistics in your book. You point out that 48 Democrats voted to reform the filibuster in order to pass voting rights reform.
Yeah.
They represented 34 million more people than the 52 senators who opposed. Manchin and Sinema represented 2.8% of the population, but may have killed the last good chance to expand voting rights.
Yeah. So I will say there's been a lot of movement in this area. So this is an example of, yes, they didn't win when it came to the filibuster fighting, but from where they started in terms of educating senators to where they ended up was dramatic. Because when the fight for voting rights began, there were not 48 votes to change the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation. At the end, it was only two Democrats, neither of whom, ironically, the Democrats, who killed. And I think what basically does is the filibuster takes a fundamentally undemocratic institution, the U.S. Senate, and makes it even more undemocratic, because the Senate's already skewed towards a minority population. And then you have a situation where, in the last Congress, 41 Republican senators representing just 21% of the country were able to block things that were supported by 70-80% of Americans, like voting rights, abortion rights, gun control. And some of the stats are staggering, and it was fascinating to listen to Donald Trump's lawyer for an immunity argument basically argue that he could order an assassination of somebody and could only be found guilty if the Senate impeached him. Well, guess what happened in the last impeachment trial? The vote to convict Donald Trump after the insurrection was 57-43. Now, it was absolutely shameful they only got 57 votes, but 57 votes is a lot of Senate today. The 57 senators who voted to convict Donald Trump and prevent him, by the way, from running, and the only thing that would have been wrong, The 53-7 senators that voted to convict him represented 76.7 million more Americans than the 43 who voted to acquit him. So when you say, just go to the Senate, just do it for the normal political process, it's impossible to imagine the circumstances that would first get to a supermajority of senators, but then get to a situation where how many millions more Americans, you probably have to say 150 million more Americans would have to be represented to get to a situation where Trump is convicted. And that's the kind of stuff that the top here. And then you look at the Supreme Court, right? For the first time in U.S. history, 5 to 6 conservative justices were appointed by Republican presidents who lost the vote and confirmed by senators who were elected by a minority of Americans. Then the Supreme Court has deepened that crisis by gutting the Voting Rights Act and making the system more democratic, by doing things that are at odds with the majority of Americans, like overturning Roe v. Wade, Citizens United, things that are opposed by 78% of Americans. And then also just giving a green light to authoritarianism, right? So it's like, where are the checks and balances going to come from? If the Congress won't do it and the courts won't do it, you could say, yeah, the people should just do it, but the people are affected by all these things. The people are living under this undemocratic system, which isn't to say it's not impossible. But my sense is, how do we even get here where someone who incited insurrection can run in it, someone who can be a convicted felon can run in it, someone who's done those kind of things hasn't been held accountable by the other political branches, because the other political branches are falling victim to the same kind of thing that's giving rise to that authoritarian leader in the first place.
Okay, we'll get a couple more and then we're going to turn to the audience. Let me ask a very practical question about this November's election. Some forces, as we know when it comes to voter suppression, have been targeting those sometimes vague responsibilities. Okay, if that was superintendent. My two former directors of elections, we have Ben Mulder, who's an election expert, and many others. You've got these positions, poll worker,
yeah,
election judge, watcher, all these critical positions, but sometimes it's a little vague. And what happened the last few years is those who support the minority rule,
mm-hmm,
have been targeting these people.
Yeah.
Okay. And including election administrators.
Yeah.
Trying to embarrass them and get them to quit and so forth. And this is a truly bipartisan problem. In the old days, like in most places, you have a certain number of Republican judges and Democratic judges, or poll workers, depending on where you are, what you call them. That's absolutely essential. The times when the Republican judges prevented minority rule from some of the Democrats, you know, the old Chicago engineer. So it's not a partisan thing, but tell us what can people do here?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe some it's obvious that to help out in these ways, you know, whether it's a poller or a judge,
yeah,
not be intimidated by threats and so forth. Tell us what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, sign up to be a poll worker, so someone who doesn't believe the election was stolen takes that position instead. Is that people say, what is different? That's the kind of thing that's different. That's the kind of democratic norms are being shifted away. We never had efforts to try to oust poll workers and oust election officials in this kind of way. And we never had 100,000 people who believe the election was stolen sign up to try to take over election machinery, not vote to certify elections, do this kind of thing. So I think, you know, people have to realize, like, no one's going to come out of the woodwork to solve this problem. Like, if they feel strong about it, they need to do it, right? And so I think that was one thing that happened in 2020. A lot of people stepped up. A lot of people stepped up so that people could vote safely in the pandemic. A lot of people stepped up and spread information, very, very tangible information about how people could vote. And I think that was one of the reasons why in 2020 we had the highest voter turnout in 120 years. It wasn't just because of the interest in the election. It was because so much information went into not just telling people about the importance of voting, but how and how to overcome those barriers. And I worry that some of that stuff is slipping away. The disinformation, the misinformation is out of control right now. I think it's having a huge income on the election, particularly among younger voters. I think a lot of people are just seeing things in their feeds that are demonstrably untrue, and they're very difficult to fact check. In 2020, false claims about mail voting, false claims about COVID were deleted and flagged on Twitter. Now the biggest spreader of misinformation owns the platform. So it's very difficult to figure out what to do here. I'm not sure I have any good answers, because the decline of local media, the decline of journalism, the kind of trusted messengers are going away. You know, in my line of business, people complain all the time about the New York Times. Oh, the New York Times is an ass. Oh, the New York Times is not. It's like, people don't read the New York Times about the problem. Like, yes, I wish the Times was better. But, like, people that read the New York Times are the solution. People who aren't reading the New York Times, who aren't reading newspapers, who aren't watching the news, they're the ones that are believing and spreading a lot of misinformation. And I think that, you know, election officials also have to figure out a way to get information out there in easily digestible forms, right? So they have to be on TikTok. They have to be on social media. They have to be on these platforms that a lot of people aren't on, but where the misinformation is spreading to try to get it across. These are the facts about elections. People are not being important to the country to vote legally. Like, that's not a thing that's actually happening. That's actually impossible. But that's the kind of thing we're dealing with on a daily basis. So I would just urge people to get involved as much as they can locally, because we have seen a lot of election officials leave their jobs. We have seen people become overwhelmed or afraid to do this kind of work. But if they don't do that work, that creates a void, and someone's going to fill the void. There's a very dedicated movement right now to try to fill the void and live with negative.
One more question that we see, this was submitted by the audience. How can we add momentum to abolishing the Electoral College constitutional amendment or any other way?
So,
that's what it was very common.
Good question. So there's two ways to abolish the Electoral College, at least theoretically. One way is a constitutional amendment. That is very, very difficult because it's basically a double supermajority requirement. So it's like the filibuster on steroids, essentially, because you need 2/3 of the Congress and 3/4 of states. One thing that's really interesting is we almost abolished the Electoral College through constitutional amendment in the 1960s. I did not realize this until I researched my book, but it was led by Birch Bayh of Indiana. Nixon supported it. Johnson supported it. AFL-CIO supported it. The Chamber of Commerce supported it. You can't get more bipartisan than that. The idea was it screws over Republicans that live in California and Democrats that live in Texas. It messed up. You know, a lot of people are shut out of the system. It's not just one party that's shut out of a direct election of the president. The problem was, and it looked like it was polling 80%, so it looked like it could get 3/4 of the states. It was killed by Southern segregationist senators using the filibuster. So it's very hard to imagine the constitutional amendment anytime soon. There has been no major constitutional amendments in the past last 50 years. I think we need to change how we amend the Constitution to make it easier to do so. The way around it is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which I was talking about earlier, which Illinois signed on to, which the idea that if states that get the 270 electoral college votes pledge to appoint their state's electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote, it's an end round around the electoral college. It's at 209, so it's not as far away as you might think. There's a lot of pressure, for example, on Michigan, some other states that have Democratic majorities to sign on to this. So it could get more soon. Of course, it would be challenging to the Supreme Court. Who knows what would happen? But that's a reform movement that I think will get a lot, should be getting a lot more attention. Like, you're at 209, what you need is, if my math is correct, 61 more votes. Try to get close and see what happens. Like, I know the right wing, like, if they wanted to do this, they would be all out trying to get 270 votes, get it before the court, figure out what happened. So that's the kind of thing that, like, is it 4 years away? Is it 8 years away? Is it 10 years away? I don't think it's 30 years away. Like, I think this can be done. And it would be fascinating to see what would happen. But that's the kind of, I think, sort of innovative reform we need to think more about right now.
Yeah, let's go to the audience now. People have some questions.
I'm very interested in what you just said, and it's very suitable, but at least that kind of move you in that direction. This might sound a little naive, but I would say that voting in Chicago these days, and probably in most of Illinois, is a pretty safe and well-run thing. I've been a judge, I've been a poll worker, so that's not an issue for us. And we have two senators who mostly represent ideas that people in this room support. So, you know, can't complain about them.
Well, I could complain about them a little
bit. That would be an interesting subject.
Okay.
But let's stick with the business of trying to get rid of the electoral college.
Yeah.
Is there an organization that's behind this, or is it a collection of organizations? One of the points you make in your book is the effectiveness of the Koch brothers
yeah.
and Chris Kobach.
Yeah.
And I really think the Koch brothers are at least, to me, Chris Kobach is down on the beach. He's a successful politician. He's been able to get these other attorney generals together to file suits. I don't see people like that on their side. What do you think?
Well, I think that there are organizations working on it, but I think more organizations need to do it. And I think more of the democracy reform organizations need to get behind it because I think it's a democracy issue. I don't think there's anything more undemocratic than the electoral college. I tried to explain to my 9-year-old, she looked like I was crazy because she's a basketball fan. I'm sorry, she's a Knicks fan. But she's a basketball fan and she understands if the Knicks get more points than the 76ers, they win the game. So if you told her, sorry, that the loser of the game won through some complicated post-negotiation maneuvering, she would be mad. And so I think it just violates such basic principles of one person, one vote. And I think every single democracy reform organization can get around it, get rally around this issue, just for democracy issues. You talk about the senators from Illinois. One of the senators is chair of the judiciary committee, and I don't think it's doing nearly enough to hold the current Supreme Court accountable. And so, what can be done in Illinois? The entire Democratic Party has downplayed the issue of the Supreme Court, except for one senator, Sheldon Whitehead. I don't understand why they're doing it. What the Supreme Court has done has not just been bad for the Democratic Party, it's been fundamentally bad for democracy. And they are acting in a lawless fashion. They are putting flags upside down because they feel that there will be no accountability from the political branches. Can Democrats expand the Supreme Court right now? No. Can they do turns for the Supreme Court? No. Could they have a conversation about this? Yes. Biden put an entire Supreme Court panel with the smartest people that was completely banned. He did the classic thing, David, you know this, point a commission and beer. Right? How many times did Mayor Daley do that in his brain? Point a commission and hearing. That's what he did with the Supreme Court. Dick Durbin could be holding hearings right now. He doesn't need Alito to show up. Hold a hearing, have it empty, every news network will carry it. Don't ask for their permission. Do something about the problem. Use the power you have. So it's frustrating to me that the supposedly progressive Democrats, you thought it was going to be too easy in the Democratic Party, huh? These supposedly progressive Democrats aren't using the power they have to hold these lawless institutions accountable. And I think specifically with the chair of judiciary, I think he's a really good guy. I don't think he's doing everything he can to hold the court accountable.
I would also just like to add that the League of Women Voters United States just launched a campaign called One Person, One Vote, and it is geared towards evolving, like World College. So if anyone's interested, you can see about that.
Without getting into the practicality of being able to achieve this, my question is, do we need a new constitution?
Yes.
If not, can you think of any amendment or amendments that we would need?
Yeah, I mean, we do. We need, no, I mean, and that's it. So there's two things about this. So one of the things I did when I was researching the book was I read the entire debates on the constitution. And if you have a few days on your hands, it's really fascinating because there were such robust debates about these kind of things at the time, about how we should elect the president. James Madison says, I think that people should elect the president, but it's going to hurt the slaves, so I don't want to do it. A remarkable admission that you never hear about. James Madison also says, I want the Senate to be an elite body, but I want it to be based on proportional representation. And when the small states say that they're going to have the same power as larger states, Madison, who's in many ways the architect of the Constitution, says it's going to allow a more trifling minority than ever to control the body. So if you're talking about originalism and you go back and say, how was the Constitution intended? You have to include that some of the most prominent framers were very unhappy with the institutions they were creating. During the debate over voting rights, Joe Manchin got on the floor of the Senate and he said, the filibuster has been the tradition of the United States Senate for 232 years. This filibuster's not in the Constitution. It wasn't something that any of the framers thought about. They specifically said they only wanted supermajority requirements for things like treaties. They didn't want every routine. Madison actually says if routine legislation was subject to a supermajority requirement, it would invert the purpose of free government, that the majority should rule. It would allow the minority to rule instead. So I think it's fascinating to go back to these debates because a lot of the founders wanted to create a different kind of constitution than the one we had now. I would abolish the Electoral College. I would get rid of this idea that the Senate, each state, has two senators. If you did do that, I would make the Senate much more like the House of Lords in Britain. That I would not make it. I would make the House so the body that would decide things. Other states have other members of Senates. The U.S. Senate is more skewed than any other state in terms of its conservative biases and also in terms of its power. It has way more power in the House to look at things like confirmation, judges, things like that. I would do a lot of things that bring the Freedom to Vote Act, the national ban on partisan gerrymandering, so there's extended elections in red states and blue states, so that you couldn't gerrymander. I would change the structure of the Supreme Court so that it looks more like state Supreme Courts, where there's, I think the easiest fix would be 18-year terms. If you could accomplish anything you want in 18 years, but it wouldn't allow it so that one party, Democrats have won. I forget the exact number.
Six out of the last eight.
Yeah, they've won six out of the last, you could say won seven out of the last nine presidential elections. But Republicans have chosen not a supermajority of the Supreme Court, but a staggering number of justices during that time. And that's just an accident of history mixed with a lot of anti-democratic tactics. Again, you have things like term limits, mandatory retirement ages, et cetera, and changes that situation. So I think we need a new constitution. One of the interesting things to me is that conservatives are pushing this really hard, this Article 5 convention to amend the constitution, and that is scary. But I also think the progressive side should talk about what is our mission of the constitution. Do we just want to defend a status quo that's broken, or do we want to try to move in a different direction? Because this is an increasingly antiquated system that was designed by a lot of people that were, and I tried to tell the story in the book, were motivated more than anything by self-interest. And you could say they created a remarkable document for 1787. It's not a remarkable document anymore for 20.
It was good for about 30 years. I mean, it's probably long since it's been done.
Yeah.
So, Ari, suppose everybody in this room agreed to write a letter to Dick Durbin. What would it say?
I would say, well, there's another question, but just quickly. I haven't thought about exactly what it would say, but I would say, you know, there should be hearings immediately in August. You should think about the power of the purse and other things you have to try to hold it accountable. My guess is that there's some people in this room that are pretty well-versed with senators from Illinois. My other guess is that probably there's some people in this room or people who know other people in the room that are giving a lot of money to the senators from Illinois. And so I think someone could probably give immediate.
Ari, I wanted to know, how do you see direct democracy fitting into some of the things you're talking about?
Yes.
Was kind of instrumental in driving Michigan in the direction that's been going, but also there are other states where, like Florida, and I think maybe Ohio, and they're curtailing direct democracy. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. Does Illinois allow citizens
to choose? I think no.
Pretty shocking when you look at pretty much the whole Northeast over to the Midwest. A lot of them don't allow referendums and initiatives. And these are the supposedly progressive states. So that's fascinating to me is that the tradition kind of started out west. I think North and South Dakota was the first state to do it as part of the progressive movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when there was a concern about basically corporate America and the robber barons being too powerful, people being shut out. And so it started in the prairie states, moved west, never really moved east in the same kind of way. And so I think that's something that I would like to see a lot more of. I think there's probably a number of states that are controlled by Democrats that don't allow any kind of direct democracy. It's not always collegiate with outcomes. You go to California and there's 60 things on the ballot. That's too many, that's too much. And I don't even say it's too much democracy because a lot of these things are pushed by lots of interest groups. I just think it's too much for voters. But I think some kind of reasonable measure of support, like in Michigan, where it's not too easy to get on the ballot, so not able to do it, but it's you have to have a support to do it. But then allowing it to pass with some kind of majority, I think, is really important. But Florida, they say, move to 60%. It's hard to get 60% support for things. Some people want to move it even further to supermajorities. Then it becomes kind of irrelevant. Also, you have legislators start messing with these kind of things. But I don't think it's the only tool, but I think it's a very effective one, because there's a lot of states that are very gerrymandered, where my guess is in a place like Texas, you put initiatives on the ballot to do things like make it easier to vote, expand Medicaid, legalizing marijuana, they would pass overwhelmingly, even in places like Texas. But those are never going to pass the legislature. So I think direct democracy is something that people should embrace, generally speaking, and it tends to be really popular, because like when Ohio tried to weaken it, it overwhelmingly failed, because a lot of people want their say. And again, there's no inherent big D Democratic bias to this kind of thing. You know, there's no reason the conservatives can't organize, and they have organized their own initiatives too. But I just think it's another check on people who are motivated by self-interest.
Hi, so we have one more, or time for one more question. So,
thank you. I really love your explanation about, you know, your approach to policy change, things like that. And I found we were really having a bit. I'm curious, what do you think would be the chances of that happening first, given all the state, gaining state into all their territories, which would increase the senators by number 12 and obliterate the need to negotiate a filibuster?
Yeah. I think that's something that should have been pushed, particularly for Washington, D.C., much more aggressive in the last administration.
But, like, it can't just be one, it has to be all.
No, I mean,
you know?
Yeah, no, it should be all. I mean, it's crazy that, you know, they're American citizens, but it's never acknowledging for further representation. So I think it's something to get behind. I just mentioned Washington, D.C., because it's kind of the most tangible example of the problem. But again, it was derided by a lot of people as a good government process issue. It kind of pushed to the side, where I think it's a fundamental issue of fairness that I think would be good for democracy, but I also think it's something that that it's going to be very hard to change the structure of the Senate, right? But it's a lot easier to put in new states. When Republicans wanted more senators, they just chopped up North and South Dakota. they quite literally did that. So, I mean, there's no reason why you can't admit new areas. It's been done plenty of times before. And that could be a way that you could start to smooth some of the rough pitches off the body.
Okay, my friends, I wish we had more time, because this gentleman has a lot to say. But we want to thank you all. And remember, there's some books out there, and you're going to sign it,
yeah.
Right? So, so let's try to leave some time for that and help and chat a lot if you want. But let me thank Lisa Kaplan and particularly Ollie Bowen.
Thanks so much.